All right, you can have a seat. Kids can head on out to your kids program. Thank y'all for coming tonight. I wasn't sure if announcing that there'd be a photographer would mean less people would be here or more, and so I appreciate you showing up. I'm a little worried. It's hard to hold in your gut and preach at the same time, but I'm going to try my best to see what happens. I need a signal if he gets like the side view so I can try and like, you know, do, okay, never mind. I want to talk about parades tonight. I want to ask you this question. Have you ever been paraded in front of a crowd? Have you ever been paraded in front of a crowd? And then maybe the second question follows it closely, which is, when I say the phrase, have you ever been paraded in front of a crowd, do you think of that negatively or positively? Right? Because being paraded in front of a crowd can go either way. And some of us could probably tell all kinds of stories of how that might go one way or the next, right? The team might be carrying you off the field on their shoulders because of the last second heroics that win the championship or whatever, right? And you can be paraded in front of a crowd and it can be the moment you've dreamed of your entire life. Or the cops can perp walk you in front of, you know, clamoring media who are snapping 1,000 pictures a second. Parades can mean different things, right? It can be a source of pride or honor, or it can be a source of shame. In fact, I would say the same parading can mean two totally different things depending on your situation, depending on how you interpret it or whether or not you cared or chose to be a part of it. When I was in high school, I had a friend girl. I had a girl that was a friend. What I mean, I liked, and I knew we were supposed to date, but the universe hadn't informed her yet. And I'm not trying to brag, but I had a lot of those in high school. And we were close friends, but she really was one of those people that I knew one day eventually she'd come around and see, you know, the hidden swan before her and fall deeply for me. But it had not happened yet. But she did, our senior year, she got chosen, elected, however you want to say it, to be part of the homecoming court. So one of the five girls that could potentially be homecoming queen. And I went to this small private school, so we didn't have like dances and stuff. We weren't allowed to dance because that leads to all kinds of things. And so we occasionally had a formal, which we just called stands, because that's all you're allowed to do is stand around. But we get dressed up and stand around. But for us, the way the homecoming thing worked was, first there was like this program at night. I think it was the night before the homecoming football game, where our gymnasium, everyone would come to the gymnasium and it would be packed out. And I honestly can't remember if it was at night or during the school day or what it was, but it was always packed out. And then there was all these activities that went on. And at some point throughout the night, all the members that were part of the homecoming court, all the girls who had been, again, elected, I don't know how that, is elected the right word for that? Sure. That, yeah, nominated. And anyways, they all got a chance at every point to be escorted by another senior to like the center of the basketball court floor. And it would be like all lights off and literal, just like, you know, those old school, you know, spotlights, right? And then they would stand there and everyone would get real quiet. And then they would play this recording that the girl had recorded, a voice recording of about how much the school had meant to her and all the people she loved, you know, being one of the top five. I mean, I graduated like 35 girls or so, something like that. So, I mean, I wouldn't say it's the highest of honors, but, you know, it's top five. That's pretty good. I'm sure I wouldn't have been elected. So. But and this is this big thing, it's a big deal, and everyone claps, and it's this, like, all the girls are hoping to be on this, and they're all excited about it. Well, my good friend is one of those girls, so she's very excited, but there's a problem. The problem is that you have to be escorted by a senior guy, and she, at the time, and it turns out to this day, because they got married, was madly in love with a junior who was one of the football stars, right? Again, she hadn't noticed the swan before her, so she was just dating a football star. But anyways, and they were like madly in love, and he was, you know, and so they're in this weird place because they tried to get kind of a rules exemption. I want my boyfriend to walk me out, and they said, I'm sorry, you've got to be escorted to the center of the floor by a senior. And so her and her boyfriend had this dilemma to figure out because he doesn't want another guy escorting her. She can't have her boyfriend who she's in love with escort her because he's a junior. And so there's one gleaming solution to this problem, and that is, who did my friend like enough to, and for, know for sure could be zero threat whatsoever, no competition, no thought would enter the mind of his girlfriend that there's anything other than a friendship going on, and I was that choice. And so she asked me to escort her, and I was just so, I just said yes, because I was just excited to be asked, and I, this is the next step, right? I mean, I'm 17, I know how the whole world works, but it didn't occur to me what that really entailed, right? It just felt like a half date to me, and I didn't have many of those, so I was very excited about it, and, you know, got a special tie with a coat, and we're going to do that. And there's something you should know about me, particularly in high school, is my, like, number one top, no doubt about it, fear was being in front of people. And I know that's hard right now, but it mortified me. I had nightmares about it. It was the worst thing. And not even just public speaking, like talking in front of people was on another planet, but just people, the attention on the room coming to me. It was the worst thing that could possibly happen. I remember having an oral report in like probably that same year, actually, where I stood up to give an oral report in class, a class of like 20 people, students I knew. And I finally ended up down because the paper was shaking so much I couldn't read it. And so I was just like, F it is, see you later. You know, I just sat down and just took it, right? I just didn't think it through. I was just excited that she asked me. And so I said yes, and the day got closer, and I started thinking about it, and I was like, no, I don't want to do this at all. This is not a good idea, but I was locked in. I couldn't say no to her, and I couldn't back out. And so that night came, and when the night came, and we were sitting off to the side, and one couple of time was going up, and I realized that, like, all the lights went down, and there was just a spotlight on that couple, and everyone was just looking at nothing but them for this. And these girls did, like, these long recorded talks. It was super long time and awkward. And I could just feel myself getting more and more uncomfortable and worked up and just panicking. This was like literally a nightmare come true for me. And so the time came when I was gonna escort her up and we walked up there, and I was I didn't realize it until I saw the recording later on, but we walked up there, and as soon as we stopped, I looked up and those lights came on, and I just looked straight down like this. And she had this recording, and she is just beaming. And the spot where her voice is going over the speakers, she's on the homecoming. This is literally what she's been dreaming of all of high school. And I'm looking straight down, and even on an old VHS recording, which a lot of you kids don't know what that is, just Google it. That didn't exist back then, but you can Google it now. And even on that rough recording, you can see as she's, that who's really kind of holding who up. And she's just beaming. You can literally see my entire body going like this. Like, I mean, just, I was, and I started, and I couldn't stop it. Like, I was one of those things, I never felt it before. I didn't know what was going on. I was just bouncing like this because my nerves were so high. And she's just eating it up, and I'm just praying. I'm getting close to God. I am just, I'm everything in me is just trying not to, you know, cry, vomit, and poop at the same time, because everything was just like just evacuate mode, just like everything was panic stricken, right? And as I was thinking about that idea of parading, I thought, man, what a juxtaposition, because she and I went on the same parade, and it was the greatest thing that had happened to her, you know, in her first 17 years, and it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. And when I say I had literal actual nightmares about that for a while, it's true. In fact, I still occasionally have a recurring nightmare. Now, kind of the fear of being in front of people, I'd still have a recurring nightmare where, like, I'm side stage and there's a dark stage, and then I literally get kind of pushed from behind and I come out on stage, and that same dumb spotlight from that, you know, King's Academy gym, poof, comes on me, and I can hear a crowd out there, and I realize I don't know what my lines are, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, and like I have no idea what's going on, but everyone's looking at me. I still have that nightmare, and it is directly from that experience, right? And so we were both paraded in this same way, but it was a dream come true for her, and it was a nightmare for me, right? And there are parades that we have kind of both things. And examples from our culture, we have examples from our own life. And in ancient Rome, and in Roman territories, when this story that we're about to read happens, the same thing was true then. They had parades that were meant for very different kinds of things. They had parades of honor. In fact, one of the highest honors that you could receive in that culture was to have a parade in your honor, to be the center of, you know, for all those that were the decision makers to kind of decide to honor you in front of everybody else, right? That was, and in a shame and honor culture, that was just one of the highest honors you could get. In fact, during the same time as this, and if you've been here a few years, you've heard me talk about this before, but whenever Passover time was coming, Jerusalem would swell to like many times its normal size. All these religious and zealous Jews would come in to celebrate Passover. And because it was a Roman territory, and because the Jews had had some history of trying to overthrow them and kick them out of Jerusalem, they knew there was going to be all these people there, and the religious fervor would be so high, they would do a parade into the kind of the front gates of Jerusalem. And they would, what they'd have is they'd have Pilate, who was in charge of that territory, representing Rome, would come marching into town. And he wouldn't just come marching into town with a few people. They made a big military parade out of it. There would be like horses, and there would be Roman soldiers in all their gear, and there'd be banners and gold eagles, not the golden eagles, but a big gold eagle they would hold up there. And they would be coming through town just making this huge show of force. And there would be Pilate kind of, you know, highlighted in the whole thing. And he'd be highlighted and honored because he represented Caesar. And Caesar was God on earth to them. And so it was this high honor that would happen. And we'll talk about a lot this week in the Holy Week is you'd also had crucifixion. And crucifixion was its own parade, but it was for the exact opposite reason, right? It was not a parade to honor someone. It was the height of how to shame someone, how to show that someone is cursed. They would be beaten, generally speaking, stripped naked. You know, they would be marched through the streets for people to jeer at and spit on and throw things at. They would be killed in this horrific way, publicly hung in front of everybody. And then people would watch them die like a spectator sport. I mean, literally, it was a spectator. People would come out with their families and kids to watch the excitement. And so even in Rome, you had these two kinds of parades, the parade of honor and the parade of shame. And it's into this context that we have tonight's story of what we call the triumphal entry, although to be honest, that's probably a bad name for the story. Because what goes on here is not super triumphal. What Pilate did coming into town, now that's triumphal. The story of Palm Sunday that every year, the week before Easter, we talk through this. It's a story of an unlikely parade that Jesus throws himself. So there's a lot of weirdness about this parade, both now and in that culture. Let's read the text again. We're in the Gospel of Luke chapter 19, verses 28 through 40. It says this, and I'm not sure why the words are like, some of the words have been half off. Luke 19, 28 through 40. After he had said this, he went on ahead going to Jerusalem. When he had come near to Bethpage and Bethany at the place called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of the disciples saying, "Go into the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you'll find there tied a colt that has never been ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' just say this, 'The Lord needs it.'" Because that'll explain it, right? So those who were sent departed and found it as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, owners asked them, "Why are you untying the colt?" The same thing you would do if someone was just getting into your car and driving it away when you came out, right? They said, "The Lord needs it." Again, apparently that works back then. Then they brought it to Jesus, and after throwing their cloaks on the colt, they sat on it. People kept spreading their cloaks on the road. As he was now approaching the path down from the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the deeds and powers they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven." There's no palm fronds in Luke, by the way. Sorry, what happened to the palms? It's other gospels list the palms in them. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, order your disciples to stop." He answered, "I tell you, if these were silent, the stones would shout out." Which that could be its own sermon. That's a cool little idea right there, right? You can't shut this up. Yeah. So you have this really strange scene where Jesus throws himself a parade. Hey, go get the colt. Let's go do this. This is how I'm going to come into town. And his group of followers celebrate him as much as a small group of peasants can. And I think there's a big question I have about the scene that I want to focus on tonight, and that is, why this kind of parade? Or would this be the kind of parade you would throw yourself? To which you might respond, "Mike, throw yourself parades? Yeah." And to which I would respond, "It's rude to answer a question with a question." But then I would say, "Yes, I throw myself parades constantly, and so do you." for tonight's for the case tonight, to throw yourself a parade is to craft a public image of yourself that you want everyone else to see. It's that thing you put out that believes you. Christ didn't need a ride into town. This wasn't like Palestinian Uber that was going on here. He was making a public showing. He was trying to put something out there about who he was. Throwing yourself a parade is whatever your personal branding and marketing might look like, and we all have it, even if we'd like to think we don't. In a real sense, I think we throw ourselves a parade every time we post something on social media, right? I am trying to form an image of myself that I want others to see and believe is true. This is the way I look all the time. This is the kinds of places I go. These are the kinds of authors I read. This is the kind of food I eat. I still don't, if you would have told me 10 years ago how many pictures of food I'd see on a day-to-day basis, I would never believe you. But it's basically our public role. And everyone, drum roll, I present to you Michael Dixon. Begin the parade. It doesn't have to happen on social media, but it's a very distilled version of what I'm doing almost any room I walk into. Some of us are better at it than others. Some of you are great parade throwers. Some of you are terrible parade throwers, and you don't know it. And you should have friends. But you have some friends that need a, let's be honest. You know, they post something that they think is helping their image, and you're going, you shouldn't have put that online. I don't think this is having the effect you want it to have, right? But the truth is, when you see that bad parade on your phone, you feel a little bit better about yourself, and the day goes on. And they have chosen, maybe by accident, some kind of parade instead of the parade of honor that we're all looking for. But again, I ask this about this story. Is this the kind of parade you would choose to be the center of? Is this the post that gets put out there that makes you jealous? Or is this the post that makes you cringe and feel sorry for the person that put it out there? Because why would you throw yourself this kind of parade? Who wants to congratulate themselves as the Donkey King? I mean, that's like the worst wrestling name ever, isn't it? I mean, it just doesn't. Why choose this parade? On the other side, with immense power, with an entire army, with weapons and everything at their disposal, the greatest kingdom the world has ever seen that puts fear into everyone's heart, that the kingdom everyone has always dreamed about being a part of and being in charge of, marches in on this side of town, and then Jesus comes in on a young donkey with a bunch of peasants. Again, it's one of the reasons I don't like calling this the triumphal entry, because I don't think this is intended to celebrate what we think it's intending to celebrate. When I was a kid, I just thought, and the way we talked about it in church was, I just thought this was just a parade honoring a new king. But I don't think it's that simple. I mean, consider that this looks more like a parade that someone is forced to participate in that's meant to embarrass than it is a parade someone would throw for themselves. If Pilate had made Jesus get on the back of a donkey and go through the backside of town and have a small crowd calling him king, if Pilate had made him do that, we would see that it was meant to embarrass Jesus, not honor him. Yet Jesus throws this for himself. I mean, it's so small, it's so insignificant, it's so humble. Who wants to be a part of that kind of parade? Jesus makes himself the butt of the joke. Why? And I think Jesus is trying to tell us something here. I think one little clue about this, in Luke's quotation from scripture here, gets down to the quotes. It says, "Blessed is the king who came in the name of the Lord." And he actually changes a word there. In the Old Testament, it actually says, "Blessed is the one." And Luke changes that word to king. He's trying to draw attention to that idea. This is the Donkey King. I think Jesus throws it to announce that he is king, but to demonstrate what kind of king. The kind of king no one actually wants to be. the kind of parade no one wants to be in the middle of. Not only the kind of king that he is, but by extension, the kind of kingdom he is looking to lead. As opposed to a carefully curated, polished, powerful, striking image of himself, Jesus throws himself a party that highlights the fact that he is weak and humble and unimpressive and going to be killed soon. If it wasn't obvious to the disciples before, it's got to be obvious after this. Jesus doesn't stand much of a chance in this fight. Jesus embraces that which everyone else avoids and hides. This is the king of vulnerability, the God who allows his own blood to be shed, the God who allows others to mock him instead of praise him. The donkey king. I think we should wrestle with that idea. Is that the kind of king we really believe? Is that the kind of kingdom we're really building? Because the question we are always left with is, what kind of kingdom does this king want built in his name? And I would argue a whole lot of what's done in Jesus' name looks more like Pilate's parade than it does the donkey king's. One of the reasons I always recommend the Hello, My Name is Ecclesia groups, we just finished one. We'll do another one if you've never done one before. It's the group where people get in there, if they haven't been a part of long or haven't had a chance to be a part of one. And we sit in the room and we talk about the church and we let people ask whatever questions they want and those kind of things. But we also share our stories. Everyone has the opportunity to share their stories. That reason alone is why some of you probably haven't done it. I get it. But what ends up happening, what I think is just telling people about those groups, is that once the first person is a little bit vulnerable and honest, it gets contagious. Once one person kind of shows their cards and doesn't get them slapped out of their hand, the next person's willing to, and the next person's willing to, and the next person's willing to. I mean, it's the opposite of our highly curated persona. Because in those groups, everyone ends up advertising and embracing the humbling parts of their lives and not just the attractive. And I think that anyone that goes through those groups will tell you that in some mystical way, God is in the room. God's there for me every time. I always leave those groups feeling less alone, more loved, more known, and more like God is actually real every time. There's something about that kind of kingdom, about that kind of community. And yet, how much of our church lives can really be described as vulnerable and honest? It makes me think of this other story. I can't remember if I told you guys before or not. I'm sure I haven't. I mean, I've been talking to you guys for over a decade, so you've almost certainly heard this story. But when I was in college, I was, if you ever do that game too, this is one of the ways, because this is true. I did 5 shows with the London Royal Ballet, which is the Queen's Ballet Company. I apologize for the mental image of me in tights that some of you are going to have to try and wrestle with when you go to sleep tonight. But I wasn't dancing. I wasn't a dancer, but I did improv theater, so I was in the theater department of our college, technically, although very loosely. I wasn't doing like Shakespeare. I was just making an idiot of myself publicly in front of people. I came a long way from that homecoming in high school. They had very specific qualifications, and this is literally a world-class ballet company, right? With a full live orchestra, they were doing Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty. And they had very strict kind of who can be a part of it. They needed a male over 6'2" to fit in a costume. And with those strict requirements, I fit, right? And so it was $50 a show, 5 shows in 3 days. That was lottery money to me in college. So absolutely, paint me up, put me in tights, whatever you got to do, I can be bought for $50 a show, right? And so I got to be part of the London Royal Ballet. I was a King's Guard, which meant I technically had tights on, but I had like armor over the top of it so you couldn't see anything but from like here down, which all of the world of arts are. I'd never been to ballet before that. I'd never been to a ballet. I didn't know any, I knew some girls who kind of did ballet. Definitely didn't know any guys that did ballet, just no one in my like neighborhood growing up. Like that's what they did. And if I'm honest with you, previous to that time, I would have made fun of any guy that did ballet. I'd be like, why can't you do a real sport? You know, how much of a wimp you would do. Little did I know the kind of athletes these dudes were. I mean, they were, first of all, they all had like tree trunk legs. And they were like jumping. I mean, they were doing things. I was like, holy cow, I cannot believe a human being can do these things. Like the most graceful athletic thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And they're all, of course, British, and which meant they all smoked. That was the kind of thing. And so it always made me laugh because they would be like doing these graceful things. And then as soon as the scene would be over, they'd all be in the back of the theater just trying to suck down as many cigarettes as they could before they went out there and did more cardio. Because, you know, that's a good way of doing it. But as great a shape as they were in, maybe because of the cigarettes, I don't know. But as easy as they made everything look, it was hard work. They just wouldn't let anyone see it. So there were some scenes when I was on, you know, the back of the stage, or some scenes I was on the front of the stage. I got to see it from the audience's perspective, and I got to see it from the backstage perspective. And the thing that was perhaps the most impressive, apart from the jumping and leaping and perfect form and all lifting girls that I would have just fallen on the ground and my arm would have broken if I would have tried. As impressive as all that was, the thing that impressed me most is the way they could maintain a smile doing something incredibly hard. And I was struggling, and every muscle in their body was tensed up. And then as soon as they would turn, and if this was backstage, they'd be like, and then smile again, right? And then smile. And they knew whenever they were facing everyone, they knew how to turn the smile on, no matter how much they were suffering, right? And we just laughed and laughed about it backstage, like how funny it was, because there's some scenes where they're just literally spinning in front of me, and they could be doing 20 spins in a row, and that half a second they were facing me, they were miserable, and then they would smile again. It was just boop, boop, boop. They could just do it. They knew how to do it, right? And that's always been the image to me of what church was like for me growing up ever since then. It was no matter how much we were suffering, no matter how much I had messed up, no matter how much I was doing something I shouldn't do, or I was hurting in some way that I didn't want anyone to know about, whenever I faced the congregation, the smile was on. It's what church was. We showed up to just fool each other into thinking everything was okay all the time so we could feel better about ourselves that short bit of time on Sunday morning. I don't know why that was ever attractive to me, but it was. Could that be the kind of kingdom that the Donkey King is looking to form? Is that remotely the kind of parade that king is looking for? So the question before us is, what kind of kingdom are we building? Is the kind of kingdom we're reflecting that comes in the backside of town on the back of a little donkey to the few screams from a few of their peasant friends and walks into his own death? How often are we as followers of Christ, as quote-unquote Christians, throwing Rome's parades instead of Christ's? And Palm Sunday tonight, as it does for me every year, and I hope it does for you, Palm Sunday always leads me to ask, what king am I really following? Am I following the king that I would kind of like Jesus to be? Or the one who he actually is? Because Jesus did this for a reason. Do I believe in vulnerability? Do I believe in authenticity? Do I believe in grace and unconditional love to the degree that I can let go of the parade I'd like to have thrown for me and feel at home in the parade of the Donkey King? What route are we marching in? Let's pray.